back to Night Search. I'm Eddie Middleton in Memphis, Tennessee, and my guest tonight is Laura Knight, and we've been discussing her research on hypnotic regression and how she discovered the alien reality of the abduction phenomenon. Laura, we're talking about the exorcism you performed on the young boy, and you found, of course, he had an adult possessing him. Was this an adult alien, or you said a demonic signature? That's what I wanted to explore, that the aliens having a demonic signature, and what really does that mean?
Well, first of all, let me really make it clear that there's a big difference between attached entities, or dead dudes, as we like to call them.
Like Edith Fiore dealt with in her book, The Unquiet Dead.
And demonic entities. Demonic possession is really quite rare. But attached dead dudes, usually they are family members or people you love or care about, or people who are very psychically similar to you in some way. So thinking about having an attached entity shouldn't make anybody go crazy, but having a demonic possession is something altogether different, and it is quite rare. There's a big error among people who call themselves exorcists. I was not an exorcist for a long time until I did an actual exorcism. I was somebody who did spirit release therapy, which is quite different. It's almost like having additional souls to counsel, because usually you counsel the attached entity, discover what its problem is, and you therapeutically get it to release and do what it's supposed to do, go into the light. A demonic type entity has to be evicted, and it's not that easy.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, having said that, when I say the demonic signature is something that expresses a certain, shall we say, using the terms of Ra, a certain self-service mentality. They may be even beneficial in some perspective, but this beneficence is always directed towards themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They have a certain attitude that their rights are the only rights that count, and their wishes are the only wishes that count, and they are energy suckers from the word go. This is just basically the violation of the rights of other beings. But as we understand, sometimes the violation of the rights of other beings can take a very benevolent aspect. For example, something I wrote recently, you know, we always are taught to look at the image of the shepherd, you know, the good shepherd,
mm-hmm.
who takes care of his flock, and how tenderly he cares for them, and how he searches out the lost lamb in the storm and the darkness, and goes through all of these ordeals to protect his flock. Well, think about it. Why is he taking care of his flock?
Because he's going to be ultimately exploiting them.
Exactly. He's going to share them, and most often they end up in the pot.
Mm-hmm.
So don't for a minute think that there can't be benevolent behaviors on the parts of some of these beings, entities, individuals, whatever you want to call them.
Or we could say seemingly benevolent behaviors.
Right, but you always, when you begin to track the activity, there is a motive, and that motive is self-serving
mm-hmm.
in the end. And that is, in the end, what we see in the alien abduction phenomenon and most so-called alien interactions.
Now, do you make a distinction between demonic beings and alien beings?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A demonic being, by technical definition, is... it's what we call a fifth density being.
Sixth density.
Fifth,
okay.
Right, because it's, just imagine, if you will, an etheric slug.
Mm.
And a demonic the characteristic of the demonic being is that it is so contractile that it has passed the point where it is capable of giving anything. Aliens are still at a lower level of experience. They're what we call fourth density beings. And they, you know, they're still at a where they can interact because they, you know, they need to interact. They have to take care of their flock so they can have their lamb stew and their warm, cozy clothes made out of lambskin. So they're still capable of interacting in a, even a seemingly benevolent way, but a truly demonic being is totally etheric. It has no physical manifestation. It inserts itself into the interstitial spaces of your soul frequency and lives there like a sucking slug.
Mm-hmm.
So just picture it that way and you'll have an idea. And
now you say they have no physical manifestation.
No. If
they can cause physical effects, can they not?
Well, the physical effects are caused by the interaction of the battle between the soul of the host and the possessing entity itself. Even higher astral beings, you know, any kind of being that produces what you'd call a poltergeistal type effect is a lower level being, usually earthbound.
Not demonic.
No, they're most definitely not demonic.
What about these cases, like I've heard of exorcism where a person is lying in the bed and the bed levitates off the floor there? Now, that would...
That is produced by the interaction, you know, the battling at a certain level between the soul and the possessing entity. The physical effect is the effect of the short-circuiting of the electromagnetic or whatever energy from the brain of the body of the host and the environment. There have actually been some studies done as William Roll at North Carolina did some tests on this kind of what you call PK, and he discovered that PK is a short-circuiting between the brain of the individual and the environment, because apparently we do interact very intimately with our environment, and sometimes if there is a short circuit, messages from the brain do not reach the body.
Mm-hmm.
They exit the body right around the area of the brain stem and interact directly with the environment.
That's interesting. Like, I teach some philosophy classes, and every semester I teach an introduction course where we get into Descartes toward the end of the semester, and he's talking about the mind-body interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And the question about mind over matter, I think if you just wave your arm around, that's an example of mind over matter.
Absolutely.
And you're saying that this could go outside the body.
Exactly.
in the same fashion.
Exactly. It's exactly the right analogy to draw, and it's because what happens is there's a short circuit, and it's, instead of it reaching the body in some way, it exits at that point. And I think they even did some EEG work. You know, they put some electrodes on some of these people that were able to do PK, and this is how they came to this realization that the energy that was being generated in the brain, you know, exited at this point. It only went as far as the brain stem, and that was where it exited the body.
Mm-hmm.
So that there is, and in Chinese philosophy, this area at the back of the head, you know, just below the occipital ridge, is called, you know, the Jade Gate.
Uh-huh.
So it is the point at which we connect with our environment, and
the other portal would be by the pineal door that's been referred to.
Well, yes and no. That I think they would probably work interactively, but for the energy to go directly into the environment, it probably would have to run down, it's electrical energy, electromagnetic energy. So you're
saying that, say, the phenomenon of, say, a bed levitating with a possessed person, it's the possessed person himself or herself that's causing that, not the possessing entity.
Sure.
And it's their result of their soul that's struggling against this invading entity.
Yeah. And another thing it can be the invading entity directing this activity through the sensorium of the victim.
Oh, I got you.
They use their energy. Because remember, a demon doesn't give anything. And making a bid move is giving. It's putting energy into the environment. They never give, trust me.
So I've always thought when those kind of manifestations that occur during exorcisms, just the demon like showing off or his power.
Well, in a sense he is. I mean, he's using his victim. But look at the effect it has on the victim. Every time this has ever been demonstrated, it's the victim who has suffered. They have been drained of their energy. I mean, I have read cases where, you know, this kind of energy and activity was produced, and the victim aged like 20 years in a day or two. It drains them. It deprives them of their vital force. It takes something out of them because it's their energy that's being used.
You say age 20 years in a day or two, would that be like an irreversible case there where they would remain at this advanced age as a result of that?
You've heard of people whose hair turned white overnight.
Yes, I have.
You know, we always think that it's a joke, but I've actually read some cases where it really happened. It's vital force that's being taken from the individual and used to manipulate the environment by the possessing demon. As you say, maybe they're showing what kind of power they have. They're trying to terrorize.
Well, in the case like we mentioned where they might have 20 years drained out of their life, I mean, literally like they would have 20 years cut off their life as a result of that? Or?
Well, that we can't know, because if a person dies at a certain point in time, how do we know that they would have had 20 more? I mean, what we're saying is that it's a subjective impression that somebody looks at them and says, God, they look 20 years older. And yes, their hair may have turned white. Yes, they may have suddenly acquired wrinkles. Or yes, they may have, shrunk or shriveled. You know, there are even cases, you know, where somebody loses 15, 20 pounds in a very short period of time because of these kinds of interactions. And it's clear that that their energy is being utilized, that their very life force that is locked up in the cells of their body is being drained and used to produce these kinds of phenomena.
So being demonically possessed is no prescription for longevity.
Well, oh, yeah.
Lord. Now, in the case of this young boy that you performed this exorcism on, even though you really weren't aware you were doing an exorcism at the time, you thought you were doing spirit release.
Yeah, well, actually, I knew it was an exorcism after I got into it, but, at the time, I didn't even know about spirit release.
Were you dealing, in that case, with a demonic being?
I'd say that this was more like a really nasty dead dude. I wouldn't even say that one was demonic. It was too easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you have some cases after that of exorcism that were even more challenging?
Yeah, I had some that, put it this way, we started making jokes about it in my little group of helpers that were helping me with this sort of thing, and we joked that when we came across some of these really, really strange cases that it made your hair stand up, so we started joking about the part of our normal exorcism equipment ought to be hairspray. And actually, when there were a couple of them that we called, toucan cases. Toucans of hairspray to keep the hair down. I know it sounds terrible to joke about it, but if you don't joke about it, you'd run screaming down the street because, quite frankly, the last one I did took me 6 months to get over it.
Oh, because it took a lot out of you.
Oh, it nearly killed me. It nearly killed me. And I don't do them anymore because of that.
Yeah.
So it was really an unusual case, too, because let me tell you, you can't always tell that a person has a demonic attachment. This particular individual came to me for what would be called ordinary self-esteem problems.
Mm-hmm.
He had problems with asserting himself. He had problems speaking up for himself. He knew he had some problems, so he came to me with a referral, and I spent several hours, talking to him, interviewing, finding out his background, before we were going to do a session. And essentially, I thought, this is a pretty standard case. We'll just go back in. We'll go into his childhood. We'll find that point in time when he made the decision about himself that his opinion or his ideas had no value, and he decided to stop speaking. and we'll find out what that event was, you know, what happened. We'll reframe it for him under hypnosis. We'll help him to go through it again and to make a new decision. It's kind of like, you know, mental time traveling. You go back and you change the past.
Uh-huh.
So you get in there, and it's a technique, and part of the technique is to, you know, use several kinds of visualization to help the person to deal with what's going on in their subconscious. And one of these is to create a sanctuary to work from. And usually I have them describe it, and then in great detail. And one of the important things about the sanctuary is the door. You know, it's okay, here you've described this place, your special place. Now, what kind of door is on it? This tells you a lot about the subconscious mind of the person, because the door to their subconscious is what this door represents.
Right.
So I asked him, I said, okay, now describe the door for me. He says, I can't. It's covered with a 2-foot thick sheet of ice.
Oh.
I should have had a clue.
Oh.
But instead, I just, you know, I boldly went forward, okay, we'll melt the ice. We melt the ice, we go inside and go through several other little operations, and then at a certain point I ask him, I said, well, okay, everything looks pretty good, and I said, do you have any, you know, do you see any like cords or you know, things attached to the body you're describing, because you have them describe their spirit body.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yes. He said, there's this rope tied around my ankle, and it extends off into space. And
mm.
I says, okay. I said, well, why don't you just pick up that rope and start reeling it in?
Oh.
He said, I don't think we want to do that.
Ooh.
And I said, you know, me? What do you mean we don't want to do that? I've never found anything we didn't want to reel in.
That's one rope you don't want to get to the end of, maybe.
Well, it was.
Unless you're really at the end of your rope.
So as soon as I told him to start pulling it in, all of a sudden, I mean, this is when it started really getting weird, because this was the point at which it became like the movie The Exorcist. I mean, I have it on tape. I've let a couple of people listen to it, and then they just get completely freaked out when they hear the change in this poor guy's voice, because all of a sudden this horrible hissing voice came out of his mouth and said, you picked the wrong one to mess with this time, counselor.
So you were beginning to think so, too, by that time.
I whipped out my hairspray. And I thought to myself, I have to get another hobby. I could be selling Tupperware.
Oh.
And it really got hairy, because this guy was, you know, flinging furniture around, and things were a little bit wild. And this was the one where I learned that demons don't really care if you believe in Jesus or not.
Yeah. That's interesting now, because I've heard different, you know, opinions on that. I think it was David Jacobs in one of his books said that calling on Jesus didn't seem to help in some of the cases he knew where they did that to try to you know, abort the abduction.
Yep, it doesn't work. I'll tell you the times it does work. It works when the entity you're dealing with believes in Jesus.
Oh. Some of them do, you mean?
Well, I'm not saying alien entities do, but I'm saying that, you know, the dead dude attachment type, you know, if they believe in Jesus. But then, of course, when you're dealing with a dead dude type, you know, there's no point in invoking Jesus, because you're just counseling somebody who's got a problem and getting them to resolve their problem.
Right. Now, do you believe there's such a thing as spiritual law that these demons have to back off at the name of Jesus?
No. There's not.
That's just something that Christian exorcists use, and of course they get good results now.
Well, they think they do. I mean, I watched some Christians perform an exorcism one time, and when they were done, and the individual, the whole thing was over and done with, I can guarantee you that they didn't get rid of it. They just made it mad.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know there's some very recalcitrant cases where they have to keep working on them. And maybe the demon leaves for a while, then it comes back again.
Yeah. And I think sometimes that they don't, it doesn't work if what happens is it, once again, the characteristic of a truly demonic type entity is to not give. I mean, they don't even want to talk to you. And at a certain point, they will stop talking, they will recede into these interstitial spaces, and they will go quiescent because they're, you know, they don't want to be bothered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just totally non-giving.
Mm-hmm.
To such an extent that it's the only way that you can ever really grasp it is to be in the presence of it because you can feel it.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, it's like a black hole. It sucks at you.
Gosh.
And that's why it took me 6 months to get over it because it sucks the life force out of you just by being in its presence.
Now, tell me a little more about the techniques you use to rid someone of a demonic, you know, possessing entity there.
Techniques?
Like, how do you talk to them, or how do you proceed, you know, with the exorcism? What are some of the things you actually do, you know?
Well, one of the things that I do is that I kind of came by this almost by accident, it just seemed like the right thing to do, is that I decide to engage them in a little dialogue because, you know, like I said, they don't like to give, they don't like to talk. However,
that's not just because they're lazy.
It's because they refuse to give.
Yeah.
However, you can challenge them by challenging their ego. And if you challenge their ego and you continue to challenge their ego and they keep responding to you because they have this incredible ego, what happens is after a period of time of engaging in this and it's very tricky to describe it third hand or out of the situation itself is extremely difficult because you actually have to be there to be observing and interacting with it dynamically. But after a certain period of time of this engagement, they begin to lose force. You are effectively turning the tables on them by forcing them. You're tricking them.
Oh.
You see, you're tricking them into giving their force by challenging their ego because their ego is their Achilles heel.
I was going to say Achilles heel also.
And once at a certain point, you have weakened them, and it's usually by engaging them in Jesuistic reasoning.
Interesting.
And then when they
have such pride of intellect.
Oh, yeah, the pride and the intellect, and if you challenge that, they will respond and they will weaken, and then at a certain point, and you can tell when they begin to weaken, at a certain point, that's when you pit your own will, literally, against them, and you demand that they leave because you tell them that you're not going to stop until they do. You will continue to challenge. I mean, I even told this to this one. You know, we can sit here all night, all day tomorrow. You know, I'm not quitting. You know, you've got two choices.
And at that point, they are not, like, undeceived. They're still falling for that little trick, and they can't resist responding to the challenge to their ego.
Right. Right. So at that point, that's when I basically jumped in his face and said, you know, all right, I won, you leave. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, the devil came to Georgia and we got into this fiddle contest.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of what we were doing. We were having this little, you know, fiddle contest, and I won. And at that point in time, the poor guy swelled up like about double his size. All of a sudden, you know, let loose with the most god-awful expulsion of gas, screamed the most awful scream. I mean, it was like something was tearing him in half, and then you could hear this ululating scream traveling across the room to the door and out, and it was gone. And then the guy just collapsed, you know. A few minutes later, bring him out, and he doesn't remember a thing.
Mm.
And how do you tell some guy, you know, guess what? You got a demon.
Yeah. Well, how did his self-esteem do after that?
Oh, he was doing really fine for a period of time. And then what happened was, and this was the funny thing, because I warned him about it, because one of the things that I had extracted from this demon in the course of this conversation was that the way and means that he had access to this guy was during sexual intercourse with this girl.
Really?
Yeah.
We get so close to break about. I sure want to get into that a little bit and how that works, you know.
Right. So I warned him about interacting with her, and she came on all sweetness and light and so on and so forth, and he was deceived, and it wasn't, I don't think it was 6 months. He was back in the same boat again. I don't know if he had the same demon or the same, you know, situation.
Because he was still with the same woman?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, you know, he was deceived by her sweetness and her, and this is, in some cases, how these things get to us. They get to us through other people.
Now, this woman that was his contact here initially, that opened him up for this possession, was she like self-consciously aware that she was having traffic with these evil beings?
In a certain sense, it was a real unusual situation. She got possessed actually at a Pentecostal church.
Oh, God.
It was during this laying on of hands that this demon entered her, which, you know, kind of blows the heck out of some theories that some people have. And she doesn't remember exactly what happened because she remembered she was up at the altar and they all had their hands raised up in the air and they were praying and on each other and laying on hands and so on and so forth. And the next thing she knew, she found herself laying on the floor with all these people holding her down. And then she was locked up in a mental hospital and put on Prozac. What she had done was she had pulled a pin out of the pocket of one of the men that was at the altar and had tried to stab somebody. She had just gone into this, you know, the demonic frenzy and had started trying to stab with this pin and was foaming at the mouth, and they all wrestled her to the floor, and then they just decided she was mentally ill and put her in the hospital, her family put her in the hospital, put her on Prozac. And then, of course, it just from that point on, she just deteriorated rapidly. She was going out, from being a nice, a real good Christian girl, she was going out to bars and actually inviting four or five men out behind the bar to have intercourse one after the other.
And it all got started by attending a Pentecostal laying on of hands ceremony there.
Yeah, sad to say, but that's what happened. But then, of course, that's not saying anything about Pentecostal churches. What I'm saying here is it depends upon the purpose, person, and their internal orientation, I suppose, and why they're going to a Pentecostal church. I've encountered people who go to Pentecostal churches because that's how they get their cookies.
Uh-huh. Well, then we're here at our break time. Let's just hold it there, and when we come back, we'll just pick up where we're leaving off. I'm enjoying this interview immensely, and I'm very intrigued with some of these ideas you put out I've never heard before, but they have a real plausibility to them, I think. And we're interviewing Laura Knight here, and we'll be back shortly on Night Search, so stay tuned.